Tonight on Arena, Stillwater, The Last Letter from Your Lover, and Boys from County Hell are the movies up for review. And we speak to Bernard McLaverty about his new short story collection. Is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Film review night tonight. Three films under scrutiny, and tonight our scrutineers are Paul Whittington and Cara O'Hare. Stillwater, most recent vehicle for one-time Dockey resident Matt Damon, gained controversy because of the story's similarity to the true life event of the Italian murder trial of Amanda Knox in 2007, and for some controversial non-film comments made by Mr. Damon. Boys from County Hell is a Northern Irish vampire tale, a warning about disturbing ancient burial sites, and The Last Letter from Your Lover is an Across the Oceans of Time exploration of a love story. It stars Felicity Jones and Shailene Woodley, among others. But let's start with Stillwater. Matt Damon, Abigail Breslin and Camille Coltan of Call My Agent fame and soon to be in the House of Gucci. Stillwater premiered at Cannes, tells the story of an American man battling to get his teenage daughter released from prison in Marseille, where she has been convicted of murder. Yeah, the film has attracted controversy over the inspiration it took from the story of Amanda Knox, who was first convicted and then acquitted of the murder of her housemate Meredith Kircher in Italy. Amanda Knox has voiced her outrage on Twitter, accusing the film of profiting from her life. Paul, this is not exactly the same story as Amanda Knox,
no,
but it's not terribly dissimilar.
No, Tom McCarthy has made no bones about that.
Writer and director here, Tom McCarthy.
Yeah. Of Spotlight and other films, yeah. People will know. He has been upfront about that, and obviously there are crucial differences. It's in Marseille, it's not in Italy. The relationship with the father is very different. But it is inspired by that and by that predicament. But really the centre of the film is not so much the daughter to begin with as the father, Matt Damon's character.
Right, yeah. And to some extent, does it matter if it took its initial inspiration from a real life story? Surely that's probably true of 99.99% of fiction, be it in literature, be it in film, be it wherever, Cara.
I think this is a bit of an odd one because it's so specific, and they've obviously changed the details. But I think really, if you're going to tell the story, then maybe actually tell the Amanda Knox story. But, you know, Tom McCarthy's had his reasons. But I think he could have made a few more differences if he didn't want to court controversy. Mm. At the same time, he has gotten the attention, which obviously is always good. But PR, good or bad, is always useful.
And I guess when you fictionalise something, you can possibly say things that you couldn't say if you were dealing in a documentary form. Maybe that is part of the issue here. So you say, Paul, that in fact it's the father character that's the focus of the film here, and that in fact that's very different from the real life case.
Yeah, it is different, and he is Matt Damon's character, Bill Baker, is a very specific type of person. I actually interviewed Matt Damon for this film, and he went to Oklahoma to meet these roughnecks, these guys who work on the oil rigs. And he told me that they're like rock stars. You either go to college in Oklahoma, you go and work on the oil rigs, you earn big money, but it's a fast life. And I think that's what's happened to Bill. He was absent for much of his daughter's childhood, and now she's in a French jail and he's looking for redemption, really.
Yeah, but interestingly enough, the relationship with the daughter, given the so-called, you know, this roughneck or redneck categorization of the character played by Matt Damon, there are perhaps some surprising aspects to his character as well, Cara, in that respect.
It is quite refreshing to see. He's deeply religious and all the hallmarks of a redneck, but he is absolutely fine with the fact that his daughter Alison is a lesbian and was in a relationship with the girl that she is said to have murdered. And there's no comment on that, there's no negativity, and there's a grandmother figure who's mentioned as well, also deeply steeped in Oklahoma and religion, and she also doesn't seem to have an issue. And I think that is quite refreshing to show that, you know, that there can be people who have very particular type of views and still support LGBT children, which is definitely an interesting route to go.
Okay, let's have a listen to a clip featuring Matt Damon and Abigail Breslin. Abigail Breslin playing the daughter, Alison here. She's in prison at this time and being visited by her father at this point.
I've learned something new, actually. It's helped me a lot. A nurse told me about it. It's about acceptance.
Acceptance of what?
Your fate. You just embrace your fate and learn to live in peace with it.
But you're innocent. So we gotta keep fighting.
It doesn't matter that I'm innocent, Dad. It's not about justice. It's about finding peace.
Abigail Breslin there and Matt Damon in a scene from Stillwater. Little Miss Sunshine is where I suppose most people remember Abigail Breslin from. That's a few years ago, and she was a much younger person then, obviously, Paul.
Yeah, she's always been, I was going to say she turned into a fine actress, she's always been a fine actress, and she's very good in this, and she's a kind of worthy foil for Matt Damon, who I think does a really good job in a role that you wouldn't normally associate with him. I think that the trailer of this film didn't do it really any favours, because first of all you had Matt Damon in it, so everybody thinks about Jason Bourne, and you had this kind of situation where he was in Marseille and there was a bit of fighting and so on. It's not really a thriller, and I think it's attracted some negative publicity for that reason as well as for others.
In fact, if you looked at the trailer, even the music that's underneath the trailer has that kind of action thriller vibe.
It's a totally different type of film. It's a slow drama. It's about character, and it's about these big themes like what it is to be an American and redemption and guilt and so forth.
And the other thing that's important here is that I suppose the whole racial aspect of the story, and Camille Cotin's character is important in that respect. Cara, where does she fit into the story?
So she befriends Bill when he's in France. Bill hasn't a word of French despite being in the country several times. She ends up becoming a guide, his helper. She has a little daughter. And there's a really interesting dynamic. There's the French view that he dresses in a check shirt. He has to be a Trump man on the same side. Bill's character doesn't really understand why he should have to embrace anything French despite the fact that he's been there so many times. But through this kind of meeting, we see the very differences between America and France. But they also get to change a little. He starts to learn some French. He starts to realise that, you know what, you're an American abroad, but you still need to fit in if you're planning to spend some time in a country. So there's a really interesting dynamic that they bring out in each other.
Yeah, I'm going to listen to a clip here between Camille Cotin and Matt Damon. And just before this, the action that we're about to listen to happens, there's been a conversation in French between Camille Cotin's character and a young Frenchman who's kind of saying, look, let's just, or somebody speaking French rather, let's just get somebody, it doesn't matter who it is, let's get them for this crime. And Matt Damon at that stage has no French. The character has no French and hasn't understood. So this is how he responds.
What do you say?
Nothing. He's useless. Merci du coup.
Au revoir, madame. Hey! 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 What happened?
I'm sorry. I can't talk to that guy anymore. He was just saying some horrible things.
Like what?
Like he just wants to put an Arab kid in jail. You know, he doesn't care which one.
That's it?
That's it? What do you mean, that's it? He's a racist.
Okay, he's a racist. We still gotta talk to him.
No, I don't talk to him, no.
Well, he might know something.
No, he doesn't know something. Bill, we're not gonna send an innocent boy to jail.
My daughter is innocent.
What? Oh, I can't believe this conversation.
Well, then, you live in some fancy-ass world, honey, because I work with guys like that all the time.
No, but it doesn't matter, okay? It's not right.
I'm not saying it's right. I'm trying to get my little girl out of jail. That's all I give a fuck about.
And you sound very American right now.
Good, I am.
Yeah, and you're also a stranger here. You don't understand shit. You know what? Vas-y, prends tes trucs, fais ce que tu veux.
Camille Cotin and Matt Damon there in a scene from Stillwater. You reckon in this case, Cara, it's Matt Damon at his very best?
Yeah, he just really embodies the character. He's quite a lumbering man. In fairness, he does a lot of kind of wandering around, like in a very determined needs to get to where he's going. He's very stoic, but he doesn't often speak, but he says a lot, and I think it's a very strong physical performance from him. We don't often see him being quite bringing such physicality to it. So I really, strong performance by him.
And overall then, Paul, does the film get beyond the controversy that's surrounding it into something else worth watching?
Yeah, I think it definitely does, Sean. I think, as I say, it's a really interesting character study. I agree with Cara that Matt Damon is great in it, and his whole performance comes through his body, like he's just sort of broad as a tree trunk, and he kind of walks along bull-like with his head down. I think it's a very good performance. I think there are moments where it slows up a little bit, especially when he's offered this kind of this do-over chance to be a good dad with Camille Cotin and her daughter. But overall, I think it says a lot of very interesting things, and I actually admire the slow pace of it. I like that.
Stars out of five?
4 for me, Sean.
4 from you, Paul. What are you saying overall, Cara?
Overall, yeah, I think it's a little slow at times, but it's really interesting and it's very moving. So yeah, 4 stars for me as well.
A solid 4 then from both of both Cara and Paul there for Stillwater. Let's move on then to Boys from County Hell, an Irish vampire film directed by Chris Ball, who, along with Brendan Mullen, wrote this script. Local vampire stalking a Northern Irish town called 6 Mile High, which has some great vowel sounds in it, obviously. How do the local lads, and there's a bundle of them here, really, how does the vampire come to their notice, Cara?
Well, they've always known about him. The legend of Abertach is said to be the inspiration for Dracula. And he's believed to be buried in a field outside 6 Mile Hill. This is a one-horse town where there is nothing to do but terrorise tourists who come to visit the tomb. So the lads spend their entire days messing around in fields, dragging poor tourists out and frightening the... I was about to say frightening the bejesus. Can I say that? Frightening them to bits by pretending to be Dracula hopping out from behind a pile of stones, until one day they find out the demon vampire is true. He really is under that pile of stones.
You be very careful. Be very careful about tampering with piles of stones. I don't think we're in any kind of serious horror scene here, Paul. Are we in more Shaun of the Dead than we're in anything else?
Yeah, I think we absolutely are. Shaun of the McDead, I suppose. And there's, as you mentioned at the start of the show, there are a lot of good Northern Irish actors on display here. And yes, it has a big sense of humour and there's lots of jokes being made. The horror itself, it's a B picture and it knows it is. So it doesn't hide the fact that it didn't have a huge budget in terms of.
The schlock is there, but it's there on purpose. There,
yeah. Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, let's have a listen to a clip which gives us a sense of some of the talent on display. John Lynch, Louisa Harland of Derry Girls fame, Nigel O'Neill, Jack Rowan, Michael Hoffa, I think, is the first voice that we'll hear in the midst of all of this clip. The gang are discussing how to kill our toch, armed with some kitchen implements and a copy of Bram Stoker's Dracula. And now, they do swear a lot as they're working out how they might kill this particular vampire.
We need better weapons. Sure, you kill fuck all with this shite.
What about some light? I mean, that is the number one vampire killer, surely.
Are there any ideas in there?
The problem with this book is it's fiction. But what's in there, and what's out there, is reality. And the reality is, you can't kill these things. A stake through the heart will weaken them, but to really stop them, you have to bury them under the earth and pile the grave with stones.
That's a load of shit. What about decapitation?
What? He's hardly going to grow a new fucking head, is he?
No, like when he's right, he's right.
Aye, if it works on William, it might fucking work on Abertach.
Aye. How do we do it?
I'm definitely not going into that room near that man.
What sort of tools you got, George?
Not sure if I trust them to do anything, for me. John Lynch, Louisa Harland, Nigel O'Neill, Jack Rowan and Michael Huff there, some of the cast from Boys from County Hell, who want to kill this vampire. Do they get that tone right? I suppose you have to kind of strike the balance, Cara, between, you know, the horror aspect of it. And I think what I'm picking up more than anything else, as Paul has said, is comedy here.
I think it's absolutely hilarious. I firmly believe that if there ever is a vampire unleashed on an Irish building site, this is what will happen. There's a brilliant moment where there's a vampire in the house, half of them are half dead, and they stop for a cup of tea and they're looking for a packet of biscuits. And I just honestly haven't laughed as much in months. And it is quite scary as well. I mean, it is pure schlock horror, but there's decent scares in there, so it's definitely got a great balance of the two.
I don't see you smiling quite as much as I am here, Paul, or that I hear Cara doing down the line.
I was, as you were, when they used the word decapitation, but no, for me, I think it might have needed to take its horror slightly more seriously, and I think the jokes could have been sharper. I did wonder when the Nosferatu-type beast turned up, what foot it kicked in, given it kicked with, but perhaps it comes from a time pre-sectarian tensions. But I felt that it could have been funnier. But I feel that I could be, you know, I think others will enjoy it more than I did.
Were you in a bad mood that day, perhaps?
I don't remember. Often am, Sean, often am.
But this is quite a cast. There's some serious talent in there, Cara. Do they live up to expectations?
Oh, they do. And I mean, there's so many of them just have tiny parts, like the wonderful Lalla Roddy, a wonderful older Northern actor. And he just has a tiny part in it, but he's just brilliant. I thought it was really well cast. And each one of them, even though it's short screen time for a lot of them, they certainly they made an impact when they were there.
Yeah, and I think you were particularly impressed, or was it impressed only by the Derry girl, Louisa Harland?
Yeah, I thought she was very good in it. I thought she was a rock of common sense in a film where that was sadly lacking in it. I thought she was very good. I believed her in a scene. I thought she was very good.
All right, I'm going to play another clip from it, actually, just to get a flavour of it and see if the comedy is still tickling me here. William is another one of the boys involved in the group. One of the boys from County Hell, played by Fra Fee, and he tells us the legend of Abertock quite early on.
I've lived in that house all my life. My dad owns this land, and I am telling you, there is something underneath those stones. And if you get close enough, you'll hear it. Like we all did when we were kids.
Aye. Try it.
Fine.
Be careful, mate. Go on. Go on.
Some things are older than science. Older than God. The earth has its own secrets.
There you go. Boys from County Hell, Fra Fee playing the character of William, and Louisa Harland certainly in the midst of that clip as well. Am I looking for too much if I look for any parallels to Northern Ireland and its recent history, Paul?
I'm afraid you are. I was hoping for some of that, but we don't really get that. I think it's just a nice setting, and in fact it's the colour of the accents and the way people speak that's the big thing.
Yeah, stars from you, Paul.
2.5, Sean, though I do feel a bit of a grad grind listening to you laugh during the clips there.
Yeah, and I believe there was another bit, Cara, around where they're trying to make some kind of go in terms of the tourism industry around this potential vampire in the area.
It's a bit, there's a road that's going to be built through this and knocking down his tomb. And if that happens, it's the only thing that keeps the town alive is the random tourist who pops up to hope to see him. So without this demon, they're going to have nothing to do. And the pub is going to run out of money very fast. So I think there could be something in the Northern Ireland Tourist Board. I think they could do something with it.
I think you had a better time at this than Paul had, for sure, Cara.
I absolutely loved it. I really thought it was hilarious. I've Northern people in the family, so maybe I'm biased. Maybe it was their humour coming through. But I really thought it was hilarious. I'd happily give it 4 stars. My heart would nearly want to give it the 5, but technically now I give it 4.
You're afraid to with Paul down there, are you?
Mr. I am. He's going to come after me with a steak or some garlic or something.
All right. So a good solid 4 from you then, Cara, for Boys from County Hell. Let's move on then to the last letter from your lover and across the oceans of time exploration of love. I love that line. It's based on a best-selling book, by the way, by Jojo Moyes, stars Shailene Woodley and Felicity Jones. What's the basic setup here, Paul?
Oceans of Flush. it's a very romantic story. And it's set in the present and the 1960s. And in the present day, journalist Ellie Harwath, who's played by Felicity Jones, who I thought was very good in it actually, is writing an article about a former editor of her newspaper when she finds this love letter hidden in a kind of, you know, in a book or a paper or something, from 1965 to somebody called Jay, a woman called Jay, from somebody calling himself Boot. And she's intrigued. She starts to investigate with the help of this shy archivist, and they start to fall in love while they're investigating. Meanwhile, in the 1960s, we do meet Jay, who's Jennifer, Shailene Woodley's character, and she's very unhappily married to this condescending tycoon played by Joe Alwyn when she meets a dashing journalist in the south of France.
Played by Callum Turner. Yes. And he is the one that we're going to hear voicing the letter here. So Felicity Jones, the Ellie character in the kind of the present day, has just come across this letter, accompanied by her colleague, the shy Rory, played by Naban Rizwan. And then it's Callum Turner as Anthony O'Hare, who's writing his letter, his love letter to Jennifer Sterling, the Shailene Woodley character.
My dearest and only love, I know you're frightened, but believe me when I say I've known nothing like this before and can assure you that I never will again. I know I will never be satisfied with just a part of you. And for that reason, I'm going to take the job in New York. I'll be on platform 2, Marylebone, Friday, 7:15 p.m. Come with me, darling. Spare him a life half lived, a marriage of convenience. More importantly, spare yourself. Seize this thing that is true and real and infinite. Yes, it is scary, but I believe living a lie is worse. We could be happy.
So happy. Know that you hold my heart, my hopes in your hands. Your Boot.
Historical materials. I think it's actually quite an undervalued.
Look at this.
What is it?
It's a letter.
Jeez.
Yeah, sad thing is, if you're going to elope now, you'd probably just send a text.
What's that?
Yeah, it'd be like, hey babes, meet me at the station if you're interested, # come with, if you want to change your life forever, smiley face, aubergine, road sign, sausage.
You see, it was much better when people wrote letters than when they sent text messages with hashtags and emojis. But is that what we're looking at here, maybe, how romance and love, Cara, is very different in 2021 than it was in 1960, or perhaps it's just the same?
Good question. At the end, I think we'll find out it's always the same, no matter the technology used. It always ends up with the same results. You either end up happily ever after or in a loveless light marriage like poor old Jennifer and her mean husband. But it is quite funny. In the modern day, Ellie is struggling with online dating. She's a bit of a mess. Her last relationship fell apart and she can't really see this poor archivist who's falling for her because she's too kind of caught up in everything. But when she starts reading those romantic letters, she realizes that true love does exist. And bit by bit, her heart is melting and she realizes that your man Rory is there with his big eyes mooning after her. Yeah. So they slowly make their way towards each other.
Oh, will they get together or not? Please don't tell me. But I'm guessing from what you're saying, Paul, that perhaps in the 1960s, things are rather less romantic, despite all the lovely words.
Well, yeah, they're a bit stiffer. And I think I think Shailene Woodley is a bit miscast because she can be really good.
I was going to say, she's a great actor.
Yeah, she is. But I feel she's quite uncomfortable here. I'm not sure if she was reaching for some kind of mid-Atlantic accent and it didn't come off. She just doesn't seem very happy outside of her character's problems. And also people keep referring to those letters and saying how well written they are. They're awful. So
could you give me an example then of a good love letter, Paul?
I have one to hand. No, I don't. But but I mean, the point is well made that, you know, people nowadays use text, and it's also. But funnily enough, the modern story is much more believable than the 1960s one for me.
And is that are you with Paul in terms of the performances? Because I would have thought Shailene Woodley and Felicity Jones, they're really heading the cast here, and they're two fine actors that can carry a film pretty easily, I would have thought, Cara.
I loved seeing Felicity Jones playing comedy. We don't see that very often. Yeah. She really has a good funny bone. And actually, I'm going to do a poll here. So I interviewed Shailene Woodley about this.
Okay, then.
And She talks about trying to capture a character who has lost her memory. So it's an interesting one to play. She doesn't actually know who she is. All she knows is she has a very handsome but cold husband, a fabulous wardrobe of clothes and this stunning house. But she is quite lost as who, so I think that's what she was going for, that kind of lost person trying to rebuild her life bit by bit.
That's actually a good point, because we didn't mention that she was stunned in a car crash, Sean, so she actually doesn't remember who she is, and that's a major plot point.
Right, okay.
Which so might account for her confusion. Yeah.
Right, so she doesn't know who she is. Now it's all making a bit more sense to me. But Augustine Frizzell is both adapted the Joe Moyes book, and she directs here as well. Has she done a good job, Paul?
I think it's quite nice to look at. I think the problem is in the direction's okay. I think the problem is in the storytelling and the coming and going. And as a consequence of the coming and going, the 1960s story never really gets going in the way it might have. The present day one does. The 60s one could have done with a little more humour.
Right, okay. So how does that... Well, let's have stars from you this first time with your... from you first time this time around, if you wouldn't mind, Cara, and your summary of whether it works or not.
Do you know, I spent a lot of time going between 3 and 4. I do think the modern story, it fits a bit better, but the 60s is beautiful. The aesthetic, the costume, the detail, and... I'm even fighting with myself here, but I'm actually going to go for the 4. It's very standard. It's a kind of bog standard love story, but it has some really good qualities. And I think it'll get a good audience in the romantic people out there.
All right. So the schlock and the schmaltz both worked for you tonight, it would seem, in terms of both the horror movie and the love story. What about you, Paul? Are you still in curmudgeonly mode?
Yeah, I really am the Waldorf and Stabler of this show this evening, because I'm going to go using my half star. Sean, I'm going to go 2.5 stars just because I thought that in the end it didn't work. Bits of it were good, but it didn't really work for me.
A half star, and it only gets to 2.5. Well, you're not. Listen, you need a little bit of time out, maybe. We'll get you something nicer to watch next time around. That's Paul Whittington and Cara O'Doherty, our two reviewers this evening, and the films we've been speaking about: Stillwater, Boys from County Hell, and The Last Letter from Your Lover. Bernard McLaverty is the author of 5 novels, 6 short story collections. His last novel was the critically acclaimed Midwinter Break, which was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. Born in Belfast in 1942, Bernard lived there until he moved to Scotland with his wife and 4 children in 1975. He has published 5 novels, 2 of which, Cal and Lamb, will be known to many, both as in their novelistic form and indeed as their adapted form for the screen. Blank Pages is his new short story collection, features his trademark attention to detail, ease of language and sympathetic exploration of lonely lives. Bernard McLaverty joins me now. And that ease of language, trademark attention to detail and sympathetic exploration of lonely lives really hit me, particularly several stories across the collection, but the opening story really stopped me in my tracks, Bernard, which is a piece called A Love Picture, Belfast 1940. Tell me a little bit about Gracie, the woman we meet in this story.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think it just authenticates the thing. It begins with the details of her sitting down to eat an egg from an egg cup, and she's eating it with a small apostle spoon. And these are details just remembered from my own existence, my own house, that we had these wee apostle spoons with a little image of an apostle at the handle. If you get the details right, then the character becomes believable. There are many other things in the story that are that have this level of detail, and it's a sad story, but it was set in most of it is set in a cinema. And the title of it is A Love Picture, and it seems an odd use of language, but we used to go to the pictures. The pictures was the cinema. And it was funny, actually, I was listening into your program there, and John Lynch appeared earlier on.
Yeah.
And John Lynch was Cal.
Of course.
And I knew him very well, and it was really interesting in cinematic terms to hear him across the waves.
and as we listen to you now, there's no sense that... I know Scotland isn't a million miles away from Northern Ireland, but there's no sense of the Scottish accent or anything like it having infiltrated into you. And while there is a story in the book that touches on Scotland, and I'll come back to it, really these are stories for the most part set in Northern Ireland. They're Northern Irish stories.
Yes, my accent is impervious to anything else. I don't know. I think it was Graham Greene said that everything important has happened to a writer before the age of 18. So that your pit or your well is to do with Northern Ireland. It's to do with Cushendall, Ballycastle, Belfast. The people that you've met and those rhythms of speech and all of those things. Although there's one story in this which is from the continent. It's from Vienna.
Yes.
In 1918, I could maybe explain as to why.
Yeah. Well, can I come back to it, because I just want to touch on something else in the first story, because you're being unfair to yourself when you talk about the detail of the egg and those little things, which of course are vitally important. But there was one sentence in this, and I thought, boy, he really has packed a lot into that little sentence. Now, I'm not going to quote it exactly, but the basic line is: Gracie is this woman. She believes that her son has been lost at sea. We're at the 1940s, so we're at the height of World War II.
Yeah.
And she has a niece called Letty who comes over to her, who's going to go to the pictures that particular night. And Letty is pregnant, and Letty has children at home as well. I think the husband is called Tommy. And Auntie Gracie asks Letty, who's going to look after the kids? And Letty says, Tommy's going to look after the kids while reading his newspaper. and the next bit is, and they both just smile at each other. I mean, to get that economy, which tells us everything we need to know about Tommy and everything we need to know about how the niece and aunt communicate, it must take a long time to pare it back to that kind of economy.
That's like, I suppose it's like learning to write. You know, I've been writing short stories from school times you just sort of fall into the way of that. And maybe sometimes you go back and you pare it back even further. But those sentences and those little gestures, they're also important. I was reared on the short stories of Michael McLaverty, namesake, when they dealt out the books, it's in the classroom, things like mauve hardback books called Fact and Fiction. and you'd come across a story of Michael McLaverty's and the beautiful thing called The Wild Duck's Nest. And from that, I've been interested in short story, and I've written, this is the sixth collection. And there was another thing that I thought was a bit strange, was that I did The Family Tree, and way back I found a relation with Padraic O'Connor in Galway.
Oh, Padraic O'Connor. All right. Yeah.
And he's a wee man that sits in metal form in the middle of Galway. And I went, the last time I was in Galway, I had my photograph taken with him. But it's not 100% sure, but it certainly appeared as a third cousin of a third cousin.
So there's a genetic predisposition to the short story, shall we say.
That's
right. So let's come to the one that you wanted to talk about, as you say, one that isn't set in Northern Ireland, which is The End of Days, Vienna,
yes.
1918. Of course, Vienna 1918 were at the height of the Spanish flu, or the Spanish flu is certainly there at the time. You must have been thinking around the current pandemic, or were you, as you wrote that story?
Yes, yeah. I mean, what had happened was that I'd reached, I think, about 11 stories, and I thought that those 11 stories were written before the pandemic, and I thought maybe audiences or readers will not be interested in the kind of normality of what has happened beforehand, and I thought, can I write a story that somehow or other addresses the COVID situation? And I had been really interested in, I'm interested in art anyway, but this guy, Egon Schiele, an artist in Vienna in 1918, he was just, what a star he was, with the pencil and the drawing and the energy and the explosiveness. So I became interested in him, and then I discovered that he had died of the Spanish flu, and there were complexities too with his wife, and the way the illness came. I mean, they call it Spanish flu, but it actually came from America, with the troops coming over to the First World War, and I felt that if I could write this story, then it would be included in what happened before and what happened after the pandemic.
Yeah, and there's, again, very touching little details here in this as well. One point, when he's listening, or his hands are on she's pregnant at the time, she's dying, and he can feel the fading heartbeat of the infant in the womb. I mean, an incredible little emotional detail, but it packs quite a punch. Again, are you saying to me that comes easy, or that just after years of practice, you know how to wait for it to come?
At various times I said to myself, that's the story I want to write, and then I kind of gave up. I couldn't do it. It was too difficult. To be so intrusive, to be so emotionally raw, that I said, you know, give up, just leave it out and write something else. But I kept on coming back to it, and I didn't get it until I got the opening, and I believed the opening of the artist coming out of his studio and seeing a light on the skirting board, and he bends down and he looks at it and he doesn't understand where it's coming from, and it's coming from the keyhole, and the sunlight coming through from the studio, and once I believed that, I then sort of picked up and ran and got the story finished. Another thing that happened in my own life was that I went down to the bank when by this time the COVID was all around in Glasgow, and I was sitting outside. They had made these offices with glass and grey or sintered glass, and I was just idly watching, and an old man fell down inside the office onto the floor, and his grey hair, and I thought, oh God, that was somehow or other, I felt, oh, this is COVID, he's got something. And then I almost ran home and put in a scene where a flashback scene where Sheila and his wife go out for a coffee and someone becomes ill in their presence.
Very similar scene.
Yes.
And just on that subject of the autobiographical side of things, if you like, or how things make their way from real life into the fictional world of your stories, I mean, you had a desire at one stage, or you have said, I suppose, that if you weren't a writer, you'd be a painter. Would you be a painter in the style of Sheila, or who would you have been in the style of?
Oh, I would be in the style of Rembrandt.
All right. Sure. If you're going to go somewhere decent, I suppose.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody the other day about, you know, the night watch, which is about 15 metres by about 20 metres, and it's a huge, big painting. And I thought that was like a big, big, big novel. And then I thought of Rembrandt, the same artist, doing a wee drawing about two women stooping over a wee child, teaching it to walk. And I thought, they are short stories.
All right. So there's a parallel there. You know, that the pandemic makes its way into another story, kind of, if you like. Well, certainly it did for me. A story called Blackthorns, County Derry, 1942. And you mentioned there about the Spanish flu coming with American soldiers travelling over during World War One. This is the period when you had American soldiers coming to Northern Ireland. And the story here about a man called Peter out walking with his two little girls, he gets a scrape from a bush, and suddenly he has blood poisoning. Now, Pfizer makes its way into this story. Was that a little nod? Tell us how Pfizer makes its way into the story, maybe, first of all, and then tell me, was that a nod to the current situation too?
I think so, but it was a story of kind of resurrection or something and it's about the complexity of things of hate that the soldiers who make their way there Peter, the man, sees a group of soldiers who are black soldiers, and they are separated from the other soldiers. This is the complexity of hatred that the doctor who is treating Peter's illness is of loyalist or origins, and there's hate, and there is he's doing this good act to try and save the man's life. So it's a very complex set of rules and a dance of that Northern Ireland dance of what people are. That's the first thing that you want to know. Are these Protestants, or are these Catholics, or are these people going to do me harm or otherwise? So that story, I like that complexity. There's a poet, Simon Armitage, and he has a lovely poem about somebody got a taxi for his mother to go to church, and then he stole £10 from her purse. You know, so there's good acts and there are bad acts.
Yeah, and certainly that's there within that story. You know, the doctor being, I suppose, his Hippocratic Oath means he has to do what he does, but also that's within him. But there are others where there's hatred involved. But let me touch briefly to finish up, if I could, Bernard, on another story that touches again on soldiers and again on presumptions around background, if you like. Searching, Belfast, 1971. This comes from your own life, an actual event in your own family.
And indeed, yeah. I mean, this is just a kind of witness story. I didn't experience it, but it is roughly my mother and my grandmother. You know that this was, as I say, Belfast 71, these two much loved creatures are kind of the house is broken into, and as my mother said, that she thought, oh my God, who's this coming up the stairs, and she shouted out, who is it, and they said, British Army, ma'am, you know.
Yeah, and they go in, they find a cricket ball, and they're kind of going, how on earth could there be a cricket ball in a Catholic household, which kind of tells us, I suppose, it's all about that idea of prejudice, which I presume is part of what you were getting at. Bernard, lovely to have spoken with you this evening, and congratulations on the collection. Thanks a million for being with us.
Oh, Sean, it's good of you to say so.
Thanks a million, Bernard. All the best. Okay. Now, that's Bernard McLaverty there, and the new collection is called Blank Pages and Other Stories. It's published by Jonathan Cape. That is our lot for this evening. Paula Shields, research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Cara O'Hara was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RTÉ Radio 1.